Hi, just before you listen to your 3CR podcast, a quick message. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. Thanks for listening and enjoy your podcast.
Living free.
Welcome to the Living Free Show on 3CR Community Radio, 855 kHz on your AM dial and 3CR on digital radio. Hi, I'm Bill, and I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. I'd like to pay my respects to the elders past and present, and to acknowledge that this land was stolen, that sovereignty was never ceded. Each week on the Living Free Show, we showcase one of the many programs that assist in recovery from drugs, alcohol, gambling and food addictions. Our guests share their recovery story and highlight that shared experience saves lives. My guest today is a compulsive gambler who's recovering with the help of Gamblers Anonymous. I'd like to welcome Jonathan Schwartz to the show. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Bill. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. So I understand you've been in recovery for about 4 years now.
Nine plus years now.
Nine. Okay, sorry. My mistake.
That's okay.
So we usually talk about childhood and growing up first, just to sort of look at the things that influenced your life and your family background. So do you want to talk a little bit about growing up and, you know, why you took the path you took?
Yeah, absolutely. I think why I took the path is has a lot to do with my childhood. At age 4 years old, my father abandoned myself and my younger brother and my mother, who was a young parent to begin with. But when my father left us, my mom was forced to become a single parent, at which point she had to take three jobs to put food on the table, roof over our head, and clothing on our backs. And, you know, to her credit, she acknowledges today that she was just very stressed and wasn't really prepared to be a single mother. Assuming those three jobs, working around the clock to care for us all, it became very stressful. And she took that stress out on me by physically and emotionally abusing me, which I suppressed all of that childhood trauma for 46 of my 55 years of life. I have forgiven my mom. My mom has become my rock. I understand what it's like. I have three beautiful sons myself, and I can understand the stress that a parent has, especially a single parent. So as part of recovery, as we know, forgiveness is really important, but I won't get too far ahead there. I will say, though, that the trauma, because I didn't have the courage to ask for it, did carry with me into adolescence and adulthood. But the trauma itself was, we moved around to a lot of different places. I remember about 5% at best of my childhood. I used to search for the facts, like what happened, where did we live, but I surrendered and no longer search for the why. You know, today I just live in acceptance, but that certainly contributed to a lot of my maladaptive behaviors.
Yeah, my dad was an alcoholic and we moved around a bit. I think I went to five schools up to grade two, and it certainly has an impact on your life.
Absolutely. And my father was a gambling addict, a cocaine addict, and those were my two alcoholic addictions as well. So, you know, as a therapist today, I understand the multi-generational transmission, the disease component and the choice component. But yeah, that my childhood was not one that was a typical childhood trauma growing up, but I accept that today. I don't play the self-pity role. As I said, I accept it today. My father passed away in 2017. I never really had a relationship with him at best when he reentered a decade later. We would talk maybe once or twice a year. I did live with him for a few months, my senior year of high school. There was no discipline. I could do whatever. I could be reckless, which I was. But he passed away in 2017. And frankly, as I look back and reflect, I miss him more today now that he's passed than when he was here alive. I think about him a lot. Like I said earlier, I have a great relationship with my mother today. She's battling stage four lung cancer over a decade. And, you know, I'm here for her to support her through her journey, and as she is with my own journey as well.
Yeah. Okay. It is a fraught relationship that we have with our parents from coming up in that sort of environment. And I think it's only in recovery that you can sort of appreciate them. It's very difficult before that. There's so much anger and resentment. And yeah. So I want to talk about sort of growing up as a kid. What were you like at school? Did you have friends? Were you good at school? Were you good at sport?
Yes, I wasn't a great student academically. I didn't have real guidance as to the importance of school in terms of, getting good grades. I was an average student. Ultimately, when I did default to playing sports as my way to escape from the trauma, and try to avoid being home as much as I could. So I played baseball, was my favorite sport to play. I was fairly good at that. I played pickup basketball. I wasn't very good at basketball, but I enjoyed it. Anything that I can do to kind of surround myself with, I'll call it teammates or others socially and not be home, that's sort of was my escape. And so being that my mother had to work jobs, she came home late. So we really didn't spend a lot of quality time together as a family.
No, appreciate that. So what about close friendships? Did you have any close friends?
Absolutely. And many of my friends from early childhood still remain my friends today. Got about a handful of quality friends that have supported me along my life journey from childhood all the way through to today. Those are really important people in my life as well today. I grew up in a great area in upstate New York. It's called the Catskill Mountains. And when I was growing up, I was born in 1969. So that was the year of Woodstock. And so I grew up very close to Woodstock. I grew up in a place where it had it was very vibrant, full of energy. People from the tri-state area would come up on weekends and the summers. And it was really a wonderful place to grow up. Unfortunately, I don't remember, as I said earlier, a lot of it, but I can recall how beautiful it was. And in hindsight and through reflection, I wish in those moments of growing up there, I would have appreciated the nature that the area had to offer and the energy of all those visitors. But I just wasn't mature enough in childhood and adulthood to really appreciate the surroundings. And unfortunately, it's not as beautiful as it once was, but we were probably the number one vacation destination prior to modern day.
Right. You said your dad was a gambler, but you never really knew him. So what attracted you to gambling?
Yeah, and the sad part is, when I was growing up, as a young adult, I never wanted to turn out like my father, but yet in some respects I turned out much worse than him. Gambling started for me in moderation. In college, I had this brilliant idea, because I grew up poor, that I can become a bookie with one of my fraternity brothers, and we lasted about 2 weeks. Before we lost, call it $10,000, of which five was my responsibility. And this was my first semester junior year in college. And so I didn't have the money. So I ran to San Francisco, where at this point my mother lived. And so I moved from my SUNY Albany in New York to San Francisco to finish up my last year and a half of college at San Francisco State, and lived with my mother and stepfather and commuted there to school. I also worked in the financial district sort of part-time while going to school full-time, just to kind of learn a little bit about accounting, which is what I graduated with, a Bachelor of Science in accounting. But the gambling started in college. It continued years later when I went to work for my cousin in the entertainment space. One of his partners asked me if I wanted to place a bet. I placed the bet. I lost $3,000. And thankfully, that partner was kind enough to pay that debt. So this is a pattern that sort of is starting to creep in, where ultimately the gambling in moderation became one with the degenerative compulsive gambler that I ultimately became.
Yeah. So what was the attraction to gambling? Initially, a lot of people talk about wanting to make money, but often it's to forget about other things. So what was the main attraction for you?
So the two incidents I cited, one being in college and the other being sort of working with my cousin, the attraction was just simply that I loved sports. I loved participating. I loved watching. But what happened was after I graduated college, I called one of my seven cousins who I had seven cousins at the time that were CPAs, and one of them was a music business manager in the entertainment space. And I said, "Cuz, we've always talked about me working for you. I'm ready. I graduated college." He said, "You're not ready. You're immature. You're irresponsible. What do you know about the entertainment community and business management in specifically?" So he said, "I'll call you when I think you're ready. I suggest you go work in the financial district and continue with whom you were doing an internship with, if you will." So I continued for about 3.5 years working in a financial district, honing my analytical skills, becoming a better accountant, CPA with a strong foundation. And so he called me and he said, "You're ready to come to Los Angeles." At that point in my life, I was married with the oldest of three sons, and we drove down south to Los Angeles, and I was the first one in his office and the last one to leave. I didn't want the word nepotism associated with me. I worked really hard. I got paid very little, but I accepted that I'm learning from a great group of people. And so in 1999, his firm was acquired. He asked me if I wanted to get into investment banking, family wealth management. I said, "Cuz, I love you. Thank you for the opportunity you afforded myself and the family. May I please take a small book of business and join another entertainment business management firm?" He gave me his blessing. And so in February of 2000, I joined a firm, which years later I became a partner. And we represented high net worth celebrities in music, film, TV, and professional sports. And I would say for a good decade, actually probably almost two decades, I was really good at what I did. And then in about 2009, I was coaching my kids' youth sports teams, and I met my assistant coach who asked me if I wanted to gamble. And I said, "Sure." And I started to place a small bet. And before you knew it, I lost a significant amount of money. At this point, I wasn't making a lot of money. And so I had this genius idea, or another brilliant idea, in addition to the bookie business. I thought was a brilliant idea, which we know wasn't. And I said, "Let me just, instead of taking the money from my own account, why don't I borrow it, quote unquote, from a client?" And so I did. And that just became progressively a slippery slope. Before you knew it, I was losing every week, continuing to bet. And now I'm in full blown compulsive gambling mode. And I didn't even like gambling. But as months went by and a year plus went by, I was just simply chasing money that ultimately I was embezzling from clients, a handful of clients.
Yeah. So do you want to talk about that issue that you didn't really want to gamble, but you gambled? So there's a reason behind that. So what were you sort of trying to avoid?
So once I started becoming a compulsive gambler and gambling every day for 6 years,
yeah,
without one day being missed and calling my bookie, I was simply chasing. Because I knew I was violating my fiduciary responsibility to my clients as their business manager. And I couldn't believe that I lacked integrity and a moral compass. So at this point, I was making a significant amount of money in my career on an annual basis. But again, I still didn't ask for help. I didn't have the courage to ask for help. I wish I had the courage at that time. And so I'm chasing to win back, as the mindset of a gambler is one of grandiosity and one of fantasy. So I had this fantasy that I would win back all this money that I was embezzling one weekend, and no one would know. I'll pay my clients back, and continue on with my career. Unfortunately, or fortunately, frankly, that never happened. And before you knew it, I was committing a white collar crime.
It's interesting, sort of, you know, hearing your story and about the drive to recover the money. But did you ever consider the fact that you'd lost so much, how much it would take to win it back? Did you ever sort of count that into to look at how you could possibly win it back, or was it just all or nothing each time?
Oh, I was full, as I said, as a full-blown addict at this point in gambling. There was no such thing as moderation. It was black or white. I had terrible impulsivity and was simply just trying to win it back. I mean, the total amount I embezzled, $7 million. And, you know, like I said, I could have taken that $7 million from my account, but I made a lot of poor choices. And the idea was, again, this fantasy that I could win it back over a weekend because I bet on every game. Okay, so for example, on a Sunday, I didn't just bet on who I think is going to cover the spread. I bet on not only who's going to cover the spread, but I bet parlays and teasers and first halves of games and over-unders. So if you do, there's no such thing, in my opinion, as a good gambler. But if I was gambling, I'll call it smarter than I was, I would have just identified one game. But I didn't do that. That wasn't exciting for me. I needed to watch every game from the start of that morning to the last game at night. And I had to keep this dark secret for almost 6 years from everybody. And that's what made it so painful. I never told my wife. I never told my kids. I never told my friends that I grew up, as I mentioned earlier, from childhood. Not a single soul knew. So for all this entire period, I'm not sleeping at night. Anytime I hear a siren, I'm looking over my shoulders. Inevitably, I believe I'm going to get caught, but I still think I'm Superman. And I still think, due to my grandiosity, that I can win this back and I don't need to tell anybody, nor do I need to ask for help because I'm going to figure this out. Just one weekend. That's all it's going to take. That was my mindset.
Yeah, right. Okay, yes. It sounds compulsive. Okay, well, so we might take a short break there.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Throughout September, we're asking you to become a regular donor. By setting up an ongoing automatic monthly donation, you'll help provide a stable foundation for 3CR. If we know we can count on your donation every month, it means we can better plan and resource our broadcasting. Whether it's First Nations justice, workers' rights, climate action, independent music, housing advocacy, or disability activism, your regular support ensures that these movements and struggles have a platform every single week. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
This is the Living Free Show on 3CR, 855 kHz on your AM dial and 3CR on digital radio. If you'd like to listen to one of our many podcasts, you can find them on your preferred podcast platform or just Google 3CR Living Free and check out our website. You can also contact us via phone or email.
Today I'm talking with Jonathan Schwartz about compulsive gambling and his recovery through Gamblers Anonymous. So Jonathan, before the break, we were talking about the way you bet, and like all compulsive gamblers, there's not a lot of thought about if it doesn't go your way, it's always looking forward to solving the problem. So you talked earlier about being married, but we didn't talk about meeting your wife or having kids or anything. And often that's a theme in talking to gamblers and alcoholics, that there's people in their lives, but they don't feature in their story because of the focus on other things. So did you have a close relationship with your wife?
So I would say for the first half of our 23-year marriage, we were very close. She was my high school sweetheart. Unfortunately, commencing around the time I started to gamble, I was not emotionally present for her or my kids. My kids were my best friends. And, we'll talk later about how much pain I've caused that whole family and ruptured the family dynamics. And also today, we'll talk later about how I view my relationship with my wife today versus in active addiction. But, unfortunately, I wasn't a great husband because I was keeping this, my gambling and ultimately my drug use as well, a secret from everybody, as I said earlier. And I wish I just would have had the courage to ask for help, but I had a big ego in active addiction. There was no humility. There was this mentality that I grew up with in my subconscious mind, that fight and flight response, the survival mode, that I'm Superman and I will ultimately identify a solution, which was to continue to gamble. Clearly not a good solution. And ultimately, you know, my addiction to gambling toward the tail end of my 6 years led to, suicidal ideation. I started using cocaine 24/7 for a good 6+ months, and I have a heart condition, and that wasn't wise of me to do. So I was really starting to hit my rock bottom. But yet I'm continuing to, despite knowing it's harm, I was continuing to use drugs and continuing to gamble. And despite knowing inevitably how much I would hurt my family, my beautiful wife at the time and my three incredible sons and my mother who's battling stage 4 lung cancer and my stepfather and my partners and my employees and the entire entertainment industry, even my indirect victims, the clients that I did not embezzle from, ultimately I embarrassed. So there's countless people as a result of my poor choices that were hurt.
So what was it like working and gambling at the same time? I'm going to say gambling and any sort of addiction requires you to have a second life, and you've got to keep these two lives, the life everybody sees and the life that only you see in parallel. And there's a whole lot of excuses, lies. So how did you manage running your business and gambling at the same time?
So prior to the cocaine becoming toward the tail end of my gambling, I was able to put this facade and present myself to the outer world as if I was happy-go-lucky and nothing's wrong. And I kept making all my appointments. I kept building a huge book of business. But you know, what happened with the gambling was Sunday night was the last night gambling for the week, which meant that I had to pay my bookie every Tuesday morning. So I would call up the bank for the client, and I would have to come up with a lie why I need X dollars from the bank on behalf of the client. And that was absolutely exhausting. You know, as I said earlier, I didn't sleep a single night in almost 6 years, but much worse on a Sunday as I'm trying to create in my head, what kind of lie can I tell the bank to manipulate the bank? Because manipulation, being dishonest, all those defects of character, I certainly had in active addiction. And you know, when I told them, you know, I said, so-and-so needs money. I need it delivered to me by 9 a.m. because so-and-so client is having a producer come over who he or she wants to pay in cash to save some money. I mean, I can't tell you think about it, the countless lies every Monday to the bank that I need money on Tuesday for almost 6 years, literally, was absolutely exhausting. And that took a toll on me, but I still was able to do a fairly good job, not a great job anymore, servicing my clients because I was inevitably scared that I was going to get caught.
Yeah, looking over your shoulder. Yeah, it doesn't help with sleep, does it?
No.
No. I heard one AA speaker talk about it as being the hounds of hell at 3 a.m., pretty representative. So looking back in your childhood then, when did the lying start? Were you a good liar as a kid?
No, I was. I recall being a social butterfly. I had quality people around me, a lot of good friends. Even in college, I was part of a fraternity. I was a good kid. I really was. I was a good kid that socialized with good people, and sports was a big part of that. You know, into my adolescence and even adulthood, I played, you know, adult softball. I really had a good sense of cult community, but I never reached out to a single person to ask for help or to tell them what I was doing, unfortunately. But no, I grew up, again, putting similar to what I did professionally, where I pretended to the outer world I was okay. I did the same thing in childhood and adolescence. My friends from childhood would tell you today that for the most part, they didn't know that I was being abused. They didn't know that I was struggling in my living environment. And that I think that is how my subconscious was wired. And that clearly carried with me to adulthood. But the gambling, is, as you know, is a progressive disease. It's one where, like I said earlier, where, you know, I think I'm going to win it back, knowing darn well I'm not going to. I wasn't a quitter then. And so I'm thinking to myself, I'm not going to quit because then now I got to pay everybody and I don't want to take the money. So I guess to your question and answer it succinctly, I actually had a healthy childhood in terms of the friends, not the living environment.
Okay. So as you progressed to the point where something happened, what was the thing that caused you to admit your gambling and seek help? What was the trigger?
Yeah, so in 2016, I represented Beyonce at this time, and she was rehearsing for her Lemonade tour in Tampa Bay, Florida. And I received a call from my partners at that time saying that Alanis Morissette, who was the largest direct victim I had, I embezzled 4.6 million from her of the 7 million total. The reason I mention her name is because she went public with this, so her name I'm comfortable to state. I'm not comfortable to state any of the other victims on my client roster. None of my clients, direct or indirect, deserve what I did. So I get on the phone with my partners in Tampa and they say, Alanis doesn't know anything about this $4.6 million that you have as cash line item on the general ledger. In that moment, I continued to be one in denial and two dishonest and manipulative. I created a story for them, which basically was in a spur of the moment. Hey, she's investing in a cannabis business, but she should know. I've been telling her this. With darn well, I haven't been telling her this. And I thought I can get away with that lie. So they asked me to come back and meet with them. So at that point, I had to tell Beyonce that I'm leaving for personal reasons and I'll be back. Really, I'll be back. So I go back into my office in Los Angeles, California, and my partners asked me again, and I said, "Listen, I'm telling you the truth. If you don't believe me, why don't you give me a lie detector test?" So a week or so went by. I was still coming to the office, and I decided I wanted to take my wife to a hotel in Santa Barbara to celebrate what would have been our 23-year marriage. And I get a call that weekend from one of my partners saying, "You mentioned a while ago that you would be willing to take a lie detector test. And so we want you to come down tomorrow to Los Angeles, Beverly Hills," which was about an hour and a half away from the hotel we were staying at in Santa Barbara, "and take a lie detector test." I said, "Okay, no problem." In that moment, by the way, I'm gambling and I'm snorting lines of cocaine. So I hang up the phone, and now I have to tell my wife why I'm going to Beverly Hills tomorrow to take a lie detector test. So that was the first time I ever shared with her the truth about my poor choices, my addictions, and let's just say that she was in that moment shocked. And so that night, I decided, let me Google how to beat a lie detector test. And so I did. And the next morning, I wake up and I head down. I bring cocaine in my car. I'm snorting lines of cocaine for an hour and a half drive to meet a former FBI retired polygrapher to give me this lie detector test. And I'm placing my last bet as well. And walked into his office with high arrogance, still high ego, still in denial, not afraid because I think I'm going to beat this test. And I believe that I'm establishing this rapport with this polygrapher for a couple hours. We're engaging in conversations. I did not research on the lie detector test, my Google search, that it's actually him that's building a rapport as he's trying to get me to feel comfortable before he sets up the machine, if you will. So, I leave his office, I call my wife, and I say, "I'm heading back. Let's have a nice dinner. I hope you enjoyed your day. I'll be there in an hour and a half or a couple hours, depending on traffic." And before you know it, I get back to the hotel. I try to log into my computer to the office, and I'm denied access. So now I call my assistant and I say, "Do you still have access to the firm's data?" And she said, "Yes." At that moment, I knew I was in trouble. And so I called my attorney and he said, "Jonathan, you failed that test miserably, worse than anybody that's ever taken this test." And so, still in denial and still thinking I can get away with this, I asked him, "What's the next step?" He said, "What's the next step? The next step is you need to come see me immediately tomorrow because you're facing 23 years in federal prison. That's the next step. So now I'm frightened even worse than ever before, and it just gets worse and worse for me. So my wife at the time and I met with my attorney, and thankfully he was able to negotiate with the prosecutor a 4 to 6 year plea agreement. And on May 3rd, 2017, I was sentenced to 6 years in federal prison. And May 9th, 2016 is my sober date.
So you stopped pretty much immediately?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I stopped. I mean, I did go into an intensive outpatient program that specialized in gambling and substance use, but I wasn't there for the right reason. I was there hoping that their alternative sentencing department would help me mitigate my sentence. That didn't help. So I entered treatment with for the wrong reasons, not the right reason.
That's often the case. First time, it doesn't stick. Okay, well, so we'll take a break there.
From every corner of the land, womankind arise!
Women on the Line, a current affairs program devoted to women's voices, covering a diversity of women's interests and hearing women's perspectives on current affairs.
Rights, militant plea, never you fear!
Erosion of human rights leads directly and inevitably to erosion of human security.
We do not accept the denial of our rights because the right to have a say over our country is our life.
Women on the Line. Tune in on Mondays at 8:30 a.m. and Wednesdays at 6 a.m. on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM. And streaming live at 3cr.org.au.
This is the Living Free Show on 3CR Digital Radio, live streaming on 3cr.org.au. And I'm talking with Jonathan Schwartz about compulsive gambling and his recovery through Gamblers Anonymous. So, Jonathan, before the break, you talked about going into treatment to try and avoid the criminal aspect of your gambling behaviour. So do you want to tell us a little bit about how that worked out and I guess also when you started to take recovery seriously?
Before sentencing, about the same time in 2015, or excuse me, end of 2015, early 2016, when my attorney negotiated the deal, plea agreement for 4 to 6 years, I went to an IOP program and also joined Gamblers Anonymous. I would go 3 days a week to Gamblers Anonymous. I cried every day that I was there in those rooms, afraid of what was going to happen to me at my sentencing on May 3rd, 2017. So for about a good year and a half, I had started working the steps. And when my sponsor presented me with step one instructions, I said to him, I don't understand step one. What do you mean my life is unmanageable and I'm powerless over it? He said, Schmuck, you're facing 23 years in federal prison. You don't think your life's unmanageable and you're powerless over it? I said, very good point. Let's get started. So we started working the steps. I was fortunate enough to have the most amazing sponsor I could have ever had in my life, who still to this day I'm very close with. I did start working really hard on the steps. I started to participate in Gamblers Anonymous. I was the secretary for Gamblers Anonymous, my home group. I really developed a strong connection to the Fellowship of Gamblers Anonymous. And now I'm going into prison, serving my 6 year sentence. There were AA meetings in prison. I attended them not regularly, but you know, here and there. After being released from prison in April of 2020, the first thing I did was contact some of my brothers and sisters in Gamblers Anonymous and said, do we still have the same meetings? And they said, yes, and we can't wait to see you. They're like my family still today. So I started going to meetings. I ultimately volunteered to be the Los Angeles Intergroup co-chairman of Gamblers Anonymous for 1 year, followed by another volunteer position with Los Angeles Intergroup for Gamblers Anonymous. I became their secretary. And going back into those rooms made me feel special. They welcome me. The beauty of rooms, 12-step rooms, is that there's no judgment, that we have this great commonality amongst ourselves. And I felt that I really needed to further immerse myself into the 12 steps, into Gamblers Anonymous. And today, my favorite night of the week is Tuesday nights, where I go back to the same home group. And it literally is my favorite part of my entire week to see my brothers and sisters and to hear what they have to say and their shares. And, you know, I hope sometimes when I share that it resonates with those in the room, particularly the newcomers. But I continue to be very active in Gamblers Anonymous. When I came home, I couldn't find a job. I was struggling to find a job. I took a job at Dunkin' Donuts. I got fired after, and I'm well educated, and I got fired after 2 to 3 months because I wasn't cleaning the countertops or the floors well. I needed that, to be honest, because I thought I came home with humility, but I realized by taking that job and getting fired that that was probably what my higher power needed or asked me to do, because the lesson for me learned there was I needed more humility. And so I started to sponsor people, and my ego dropped to a healthy version of ego, where my humility was way above my isms as well as my ego. And I took another job working as an auto salesperson. And in the state of California, the Department of Motor Vehicles governs auto salespeople. And what happened was they gave me a 3 to 4 month probationary license. And then about after 3 months, they let the general manager of the dealership know that that's no longer approved and I can no longer work as an auto salesperson. So I decided that I was going to go to an administrative hearing because I wanted to appeal it. During the hearing, the judge loved how much I rehabilitated. The judge wanted me to go back to work, but the Department of Motor Vehicles lawyer said, no way. And he expounded on it, and I'll never forget this. He said, Jonathan, we're not going to approve you to have an auto salesperson license because auto salespeople is the number one industry filled with people of integrity. And the old Jonathan in the Act of Addiction would have said, are you kidding me? That's no disrespect, by the way, to anyone who's listening that's career as an auto salesperson. But let's be honest, I can tell you from my short experience that many of them are trying to fill their pockets by maximizing their commissions, when honestly all I was doing was encouraging the clients to say that this is the price based on this strategic relationship the dealership had with TrueCar, which is a company that that you can't beat their price. And if you're a dealership that works with them, the dealership has to honor the price. So I said, tell my boss that you got the price from TrueCar. What that did was pay me significantly less. And I came home with zero money, no assets, but tremendous amount of liabilities. But I was in recovery, and as I still am. And for me, recovery is being honest, no longer manipulative and dishonest. And my behavior today is congruent with my pro-recovery behavior. And so I could look them in the eye and say, I can give you the best price. So anyway, after that loss of the opportunity to work as an auto salesperson, I decided my higher power is telling me it's time for you really to help your brothers and sisters. So I went to addiction studies school. I got my CADAC, which is certified addiction drug counselor. I went on to grad school to become a marriage and family therapist with an emphasis in addiction and trauma. And so today in my life, I am completely all about my recovery and paying forward what was once given to me. And I'm really grateful. I don't make a lot of money today, but I'm the happiest I've ever been. I work in treatment as a program director and a therapist at one luxury 6-bed detox and residential. It's now actually 2 homes, so we have 12 beds. And I also work for another treatment center aside from Altus Rehab called Chabad Treatment Center, which is a Medi-Cal facility. I do teletherapy with a handful of young men who struggle with mental health and addiction. And so today my world is filled with gratitude that I get to wake up every morning and be of service to others. And I continue to make progress every day. I continue to work on step 10 in real time, not at night, but in real time as I see myself doing the next right action. I need, for me, for my recovery, I need to compare and contrast in that moment by me internally validating myself, no longer people pleasing and seeking external validation. I say to myself, Jonathan, be proud of yourself because today you did this and an act of addiction you would not have. So for me, that's a daily measurement of my progress, which is one day at a time. I'm far from perfect today, but I'm proud of who I've become and who I'm becoming. And this 12-step community of Gamblers Anonymous has saved my life. I just signed up as a volunteer on the national hotline for Gamblers Anonymous. I have a strong recovery plan, but I'm just as susceptible to any person with one day under their belt to a relapse. And I like to call myself a nerd today, a proud nerd. I'm risk adverse today. I have real negative consequences if I were to relapse, and I'm not willing to take that risk anymore. I'm still trying to earn back the love of two of my three beautiful sons. And the way to do that is not through the mouth that I have, because most people remember a mouth that was dishonest and manipulative. So for me, earning it back has been over 9 years, and it's not happening at my timeline, but Jonathan's will put me here. So I have to surrender, or not I have to, I get to surrender to my higher power and pray every day that my two of my three other sons will come back in my life. Again, accepting that it's no longer on my time, it's on their time, and I respect that. And when that happens, and one day I get to have a barbecue with three of my children together, will be the greatest day of my life.
Yeah. You mentioned trust. So do you want to talk a little bit about how much effort it takes to get people to trust a gambler, a recovering gambler?
Absolutely. It takes time. It takes patience. It takes adopting, you know, turning your life over to a higher power and having humility and really recognizing and holding yourself accountable, as I do, for all the wrongs that I did. It takes realizing that who am I to judge those that I impacted, like my children, and how I made them feel. I have tremendous empathy for how my kids feel. I'm not here to convince them that I'm a better person today than their dad from yesterday. The only way I can do that, as I know it, is to just let them observe me. And that goes for anybody. If you want to take the time to see how I conduct myself on a daily basis, I think you will begin to trust me. But if you don't, I accept that as well, because I'm not in the business, as I said earlier, about people pleasing. So for me, I can now look myself in a mirror and say that I am proud of who I've become and who I'm becoming. It happens with acceptance. It happens with patience. It happens to participating in Gamblers Anonymous on a consistent, regular basis. It happens because I sponsor people. It happens because I believe I'm making an impact on the people that come into the treatment center. I'm doing the best I can today. I may not be able to help everybody, but I'm certainly willing to try. And this is where I now dedicate my life. And I don't want people to have an experience that I had. I want people to have the courage to be vulnerable, which I am today, and be transparent, which I am today, and be authentic, which I am today. But to take that courage to another step and ask for help, a courage in which I didn't have. And had I had the courage to ask for help, perhaps things would have been different. But I don't live in my past, but I also don't forget my past.
Yeah, it's a matter of accepting that you didn't know a better way. You didn't know how to handle it. And that's the thing. And once you start recovery, you realize it's now your responsibility, that now you are responsible. Before you didn't know, now you do know, and you can't unknow it. You can't act as if you didn't know, which is good. It's a nice thing. So I want to talk about the relationship with your wife and your kids. So do you want to talk about sort of building back a relationship with your wife?
So when I came home in 2020, I was on 16 months of home confinement with an ankle monitor. Part of the rules of being on home confinement is that you have to have a landline. So I tried to call my wife from my cell phone, which was a whole new cell phone and number. She picked it up, and she wasn't ready to hear amends. I mean, it's not just my addiction that hurt my wife. And it's also I committed infidelity. She didn't deserve any of that. As I reflect on my time during active addiction and how I didn't treat her with the respect that she deserved, you know, I just wish that the second time I called on my landline and made amends and she allowed me to do that, she chooses not to talk to me today, and I totally respect her. She's in another relationship. She's super happy. I couldn't be happier for her. But it doesn't discount the fact that I wish I could have given her that emotional presence and respect that I was unable to give her during my active addiction. So we're divorced. She divorced me shortly after my sentence. But I understand that. I would have divorced myself, to be honest. And, you know, I'm not proud of that. But again, I choose not to care. I don't carry resentments anymore. I blamed everybody in active addiction and took no responsibility. Today, I blame nobody but myself for my poor choices. You know, they say the biggest, as I see it in my experience now in the world of recovery, controversial question in the global addiction community is, addiction a disease or is it a choice? And there is a disease component as evidenced by clinical research of multi-generational transmission. But I don't use that as an excuse. I do believe it's a hybrid. I believe there's a disease component, but then there ultimately becomes a choice. And so I made many poor choices. And I heard a beautiful woman in my wife that I can't take that back, but I can forgive myself for that. I still hope and pray that my two kids, as I mentioned earlier, of the three will come back in my life. I do speak to my youngest son every day. He is also my rock, and I'm grateful that he's willing to communicate with me on a daily basis, because when I get his call or when I get the opportunity to call my mother, because my mother with stage 4 cancer is not promised tomorrow. So the opportunity that I'm grateful for and blessed for is that I can get to speak to her today, and because I don't know what tomorrow brings. I get to speak to my young boy today and hope and pray that my other two will come back in my life. But these things are the consequences of people like myself who make poor choices. And the idea of consequences, and you know, you probably know this as well as I do, cognitive behavioral therapy says that every choice we make has an irrational consequence and a rational consequence. In active addiction, many of us, but I'll speak for myself, absolutely made irrational choices impulsively. Today, I ask myself that question when I make any choice, small, medium, or large in my life. And that question is, what's the irrational side of this decision, or what's the rational side of it? I generally take the rational side today and I process. I certainly don't have impulsivity anymore or obsessive compulsive thoughts or behaviors. But my recovery, I put first. Because if I'm still sober when I wake up tomorrow morning, it has a positive ripple effect on all the clients that I see on a daily basis, but it also has a positive ripple effect on how I present myself authentically to my children if they were to observe me in totality, and anyone else that I care to still earn back that trust. I don't believe in a quantity of people around me as important. I believe in surrounding myself with quality of people, largely made up of sober peers. I do have within that inner circle, like I mentioned earlier, a lot of quality non-sober peers in my life, not a lot, a handful from my childhood. If you have time, I'll give you a 2-minute story that really taught me that lesson.
Yeah, before we do that, I'd just like to ask you to talk about repairing the relationship with your mom.
So my mother and I, when she was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, my brother asked me to please call her up. That was over a decade ago. I called her and I said, what can I do to support you? I went up to Northern California where she lives and I met with her oncologist, and that was the day that I really started to truly forgive her. Later on, when I came home, I had a ghostwriter that was helping me write my book of my life story, and we've interviewed several people, including my mother. On that call, the intent of having my mother on as an interviewee was to see if she can fill in that gap, those gaps for me, those gaps where I didn't know where I lived at age 5, at age 8, at age 11. And she started to cry and she said, I don't know myself, Jonathan, but what I do know is I did abuse you and I hurt you and I'm sorry I wasn't a good mom. I said to her in that moment, Mom, that's what I've been waiting to hear my whole life. I'm sorry. And even today, somatically, although it's no longer suppressed, I have tears coming to my eyes as I share that story. I said to my mom, I love you. Again, as a parent myself, I understand how difficult it is to raise children today, especially at your age, Mom, when you raised me and my brother. I 100% forgive you. And as I said earlier, she is my rock. And I pray for her every day.
Yeah, I was fortunate to get into recovery myself and to have a good relationship with my dad for about 25 years until he died. He kept drinking, but because I was in recovery, I could have a decent relationship with him because it was up to me, not him. And, yeah, it was really nice to be able to have a normal, you know, as much as normal as you can with an active alcoholic, but a normal relationship with a parent, one, instead of one that had been fractured for so long.
Yeah, and even with my dad, you know, my dad, who he died in 2017 before I was sentenced, but we, like I said, we only saw each other maybe once or twice a year. But today I can say that I miss him more now that he's gone than when he was here. And, you know, I wish that I was more proactive in trying to connect with him, but I still had that trauma inside me. And I do miss him a lot as well.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so we might finish up there. That's about all we've got of the show today. So I'd like to thank Jonathan for sharing his gambling recovery story with us and talking about how his involvement in Gamblers Anonymous has helped in his recovery. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me.
Been a pleasure. Up next week, we've got Michael interviewing an alcoholic and talking about recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous.
Coming up next, we have Bell & Wah, The Spirit of Wah, hosted by Uncle Tall Jim Choco Edwards. Join Uncle Choco in The Spirit of Wah on a journey of belonging and movement through sing-alongs and yarn. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned now for more Radical Radio on 3CR.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au and thanks for your support.